The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We have a lot to get to on today's program, a strong theme on history. We'll look at the law of history later on in this this program. And also, toward the end, we'll examine God's positive view of history. This is something that's brought out in my father's booklet, The Former Prophets. And so we'll try to get our minds to wrap around God's view or God's perspective when it comes to this subject. We touched on this yesterday, and as I said on yesterday's program, I think there's a fair bit more that we can get into. But first, I wanted to start with a proclamation that President Trump put out yesterday. We're coming up to his one-year anniversary, 1 year in office, as of January 20th, which is just a few days away. And if you remember last year, I think the inauguration was on a Friday, and then following that weekend after the inauguration, we put together a program the Monday after on the Jeroboam end. And on that program, we talked a lot about just how this current leader of the United States, he really is leading, in many ways, he's leading a religious movement. If you remember, we talked about all of the religious undertones there during the Inauguration Day festivities, and even the Saturday and Sunday after the inauguration. But on the Inauguration Day itself, there were all kinds of prayers and invocations and benedictions and so on. President Trump was sworn in using two Bibles. During his inaugural address, he referred to God several times. He quoted from Psalms 133. He even referred to Americans as God's people and said that Americans were righteous and said that God would protect us. So as I say, some strong religious undertones. He met with 26 religious leaders, by the way, the day after the inauguration. And my father had brought out, this is soon after his election, in early November 2016, my father, if you remember, wrote a coworker letter, November 23rd, 2016, and he said, President-elect Trump received over 80% of the evangelical vote and a large portion of the Catholic vote. He really is leading most of America's religious people. And that's significant, again, coming back to this Jeroboam prophecy spoken of in Amos chapter 7, verses 12 and 13. It says, "Also Amaziah said unto Amos, O you seer, go, flee you away into the land of Judah, and eat and there eat bread, and prophesy there, but prophesy not again anymore at Bethel, for it is the king's chapel." This is the king's chapel. Look, get your message out of here. Take it over to Judah. If you've got such a big work going on in Judah, take your prophetic warning over there. We don't like your religion. We rather like our religion. The king's chapel. Look at that. My father said in the letter, Amaziah is being directed by Jeroboam about what to say. He's saying, tell them to get out of here. This is the king's chapel, the president's domain. This is our religious place. Get out of this land, because we will have none of that message. They're not going to like the warning from God, which of course comes out of the Bible. But even as we've noted so many times on this program, even many traditional Christians today, I mean, when it comes to God's corrective hand, or when it comes to the prophecies of God, so many of them don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. this movement that has so much hope and optimism for the future of the United States, it certainly doesn't want to hear the many prophecies that talk about America's downfall. Well, as for this presidential proclamation, President Trump, yesterday, he proclaimed January 16th, 2018, to be Religious Freedom Day. It's an interesting proclamation. You can find it at the White House website. But it says here, our forefathers, seeking refuge from religious persecution, believed in the eternal truth that freedom is not a gift from the government, but a sacred right from Almighty God. He says, on the coattails of the American Revolution, on January 16th, 1786, I wasn't even aware of this, from 1786, but it says the Virginia General Assembly passed the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. The seminal bill, penned by Thomas Jefferson, states that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. And then the proclamation says that 5 years after that was written, that was again in the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, but 5 years later, the principles in that document served as the inspiration for the First Amendment. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution, the amendment that affirms Americans' right to choose and exercise faith without the government interfering. President Trump, again, wrote in this proclamation yesterday, our Constitution and laws guarantee Americans the right not just to believe as they see fit, but to freely exercise their religion. And this is something, certainly, that God's work is very thankful for. And really, if you look back early on in the work of God during the 20th century, Herbert Armstrong, he talked often about why God situated his headquarters work in the United States, and it had to do with those freedoms and certainly the blessings that God bestowed upon Manasseh as well. President Trump says here, unfortunately, not all have recognized the importance of religious freedom, whether by threatening tax consequences for particular forms of religious speech or forcing people to comply with laws that violate their core religious beliefs without sufficient justification. These incursions, little by little, can destroy the fundamental freedom underlying our democracy. Therefore, soon after taking office, he says, I addressed these issues in an executive order that helps ensure Americans are able to follow their consciences without undue government interference. So he talks about the directives that he made soon after coming into office. And then the document concludes with the proclamation itself, which says, now therefore I, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim January 16th, 2018, as Religious Freedom Day. Religious Freedom Day. The current President of the United States, leading a religious movement in so many ways, and also to his credit here, I mean, reminding Americans of this history, this important history, history that so many Americans should be proud of, all of America, and yet it's history that many have forgotten, as he alludes to even in the proclamation. You see, well, he talks about how he came into office and basically tried to correct some wrongs that had crept into the thinking and the directives and the executive actions of previous presidents. History in the United States that has allowed for, in the case of this work, It's allowed for this work to expand and grow. Again, the prosperity of Manasseh has certainly factored in as well. That's prophesied. But also the tremendous freedoms. And we're seeing many of them disappear in the United States. And of course, we know where all of this is leading ultimately for the whole nation. That's talked about at the closing chapters of the United States and Britain in prophecy. But to just focus in on this history point for a minute, as I said, there will be a theme, a history theme that runs through this program. But my father, he made this point actually in Daniel Unlocks Revelation about how that European leaders today are so passionate about their traditions. You'll see them routinely bring up the traditions of someone like Charlemagne, even though if you look at the actual history, there's a trail of blood and violence that follows everywhere that Charlemagne went. And yet, these European leaders, there's going to be a seventh and final resurrection, in fact, of the Holy Roman Empire in the tradition of Charlemagne. That's right. One final resurrection. And my father says here, it amazes me that they can hang on to their evil traditions and false religion, and yet the Laodiceans, God's people, Revelation 3, seventh and final era of God's church, these people can so quickly reject God's true religion. And then he asks here, how fiercely will we fight and hang on to the end for God's truth? So how much will we remember our history? Yesterday I went through 2 Thessalonians 2 about holding on to those traditions and not just letting them go, or as he says, so quickly turning away from it. That's what we've seen happen in this final era of God's church. And we've seen it happen in our nations as well. Here's the President of the United States trying to draw attention to some important history that affects every American. And yet so many are either blind to it or indifferent when it's brought up, or maybe just totally ignorant of it because they haven't been educated. I meant to get to this article yesterday. It's from 1985, which is stunning, really, when you consider the contents of this piece, from the New York Times. And to think that it's now, well, over 32 years old, I guess. But the title, this is from the New York Times, The Decline and Fall of Teaching History. Now, I don't know for sure, but I suspect you probably wouldn't see a title like that today in the New York Times. But in 1985, I mean, this was an alarming article. It should have been. It says here, if knowledge of the past is in fact relevant to our ability to understand the present and to exercise freedom of mind, as totalitarian societies, both real and fictional, acknowledge by stringently controlling what may be studied or published, then there is cause for concern about many Americans' sense of history. There's cause for concern, the New York Times said. 32 years ago, the threat to our knowledge of the past comes, however, not from government censorship, and I think some might argue that today, but at least in some form or fashion. But you, as I've covered on so many of these programs, I mean, you just have, like Isaiah 59 says, you have such a hard time finding the truth. Whether it be from censorship or bias or ignorance or just a willingness for some to tell flat out lies that they know to be lies. We discussed an article this morning in a staff meeting about, I didn't bring it down here with me. It's about Mahmoud Abbas. Who just, well, the Israelites never existed in Israel, things like that. The Jews, David Ben-Gurion worked together with the Nazis to try to kill Jews. Just all these bizarre claims. And he has some kind of a degree or doctorate in history of all things. And as the title of the article brings out, he's the world's worst historian. The worst. And that's saying something. Because there's a lot of bad ones in the world today. The threat to our knowledge of the past comes, however, not from government censorship, but from indifference and ignorance, it says. And then it quotes someone here at the end, the erosion of historical understanding seems especially pronounced among the generation under 35. So says the New York Times in 1985. Those 35 and unders from 85 would be in their 50s and 60s and 70s today, which begs the question, if that was the way it was in 1985, what does it say about the current generation of young people and their knowledge of the past? We, as I say, we had a staff meeting this morning and a lively discussion on how we might be able to discuss the law of history more and talk about it more and put more articles in our publications more. I mean, my father brings this out in his writings. The law of history he's written before, I think the opening chapter of the former prophet's book is something like when history becomes prophecy. I think I have a quote from that that booklet later. But coming back to this this 1985 article, it says, my students are not stupid, but they have an abysmal background in American or any other kind of history, says Thomas Kessner, who teaches American history at a community college in Brooklyn. These are college students. And he says, you know, they're bright young people, but they have an abysmal background in American or any other kind of history. He goes on to say they never heard of Daniel Webster, don't understand the Constitution, don't know the difference between the Republican and Democratic parties. And then the New York Times says this gloomy assessment was echoed by Naomi Miller, chairman of the history department at the Hunter College of New York. My students have no historical knowledge on which to draw when they enter college. They have no point of reference for understanding World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, or the Holocaust. The Times says here, more than ignorance of the past, however, she finds an indifference to dates and chronology or causation. They think that everything is subjective. They have plenty of attitudes and opinions, but they lack the knowledge to analyze a problem. Does that sound familiar? I mean, that was there in 1985. You look today at all the opinions that people have, and the utter lack of knowledge, and the inability to analyze a problem, and certainly the inability to fix a problem. Professor Miller believes that we're in danger of bringing up a generation without historical memory. She says this is a dangerous situation. It is dangerous, and all the more so today, more than a generation removed from when this article was written, 1985. Yesterday, I played a clip from my father's program, Learning from History, and here's just a portion of that clip that I played, clip one.
Now, there has been a big change, and I tell you, there's been an alarming change. Why? What does it mean? Are we right today, or were we right in the past? And I'll tell you, that philosophy and that understanding and that learning history had, as I said before, had everything to do with making Winston Churchill what he was, the leader he was. And I think the very fact that we've changed and gone from one extreme to the other is one of the greatest warnings about the direction of this nation, and the United Kingdom's going the same way.
It's one of the greatest warnings about the direction our nation is headed. That was from a program in 2004. Those previous quotes that I gave to you, again, an article from 1985. And if you look at the end of that article from 1985, The author of that piece concludes that the study of history is in jeopardy, and that a society without a sense of history is like an individual without memory. Just think what it would be like each day if you woke up and you had no prior knowledge or even memory of what happened previously. You'd just walk through life that day clueless, having no clue about the meaning or purpose of anything. And that's the way so many people in America and Britain, as he says there at the end of that clip, that's the way so many of us are going about our daily lives. And if it was that bad in 1985, how much worse is it today? Where, as my father's brought out before, there's so many even college courses or college pursuits, degrees that is, where history's not even required, and very little's required, even if you're pursuing history as a course or a degree or a doctorate, a PhD, or whatever. Now, there are some that certainly study history, and there's plenty of books on history. But that's just the thing. Like Solomon said, I mentioned this previously on a program, but like Solomon said there at the end of Ecclesiastes, I mean, of the making of books and such, there's no end. There's information everywhere. But look at how little understanding we have. Look at how much ignorance there is. Look at the inability of young people or any people for that matter to analyze and to solve a problem. Look how much indifference there is when it comes to understanding and knowing our own history. That 85 article, it says here, during the past generation, the amount of time devoted to historical studies in American public schools has steadily decreased. So, I mean, this set in the 1950s and 60s. About 25 years ago, it says, most public high school youths studied 1 year of world history and one of American history. Can you believe that? You can go back to 1960, to a time when American high school students, they got one full year of American history, and then another full year of world history. Today, I mean, that's kind of all combined in one, and it's under the umbrella of typically social studies. It says, in contrast, the state schools of many other Western nations require the subject to be studied almost every year. I mean, this is an article in 1985 saying that 1 year for this and 1 year for that is not enough. You compare it to other nations, other Western nations, where they're studying history every year. Now, again, that was from 1985. I suspect it's a lot worse for other Western nations as well. I mean, we're seeing so much history repeat itself, so much bad history. And that's largely because of the ignorance and the indifference that's set in. That younger generation of 1985, those are the leaders of today. Those are the 50-year-olds, the 60-year-olds, the 70-year-olds. And they're the ones leading the nations now. It's frightening, this course that we're on. How much worse is it going to get before the whole world explodes in violence? Well, you fast forward from 1985. Here's a more recent piece from the New York Post from a year ago, January 2017. And it just explains here why schools have stopped teaching American history. I mean, they just don't teach it. They've stopped it. A 2014 report by the National Assessment of Educational Progress showed that an abysmal 18% of American high school kids were proficient in U.S. history. 18%. That's it. When colleges such as Stanford declined to require Western civilization classes, or high schools proposed changing their curriculum so that history is taught only from 1877, so just the last 130 years or so, that's happened before in states in the U.S. And this article brings out when you hear reports about it, doesn't even make any waves. No one even reports on it. No one cares. It says a 2012 story in Perspectives on History magazine by a University of North Carolina professor, by a North Carolina professor, found that 88% of elementary school teachers considered teaching history a low priority. These are the teachers themselves. These are the teachers that, in some cases, would have been the younger generation back in 1985. And they were brought up on, a curriculum that didn't include much history. And so here they are in the position of teacher now, and they don't consider it to be a very high priority. 88%! There's an attitude of indifference and ignorance among the teaching class now. Our poor young people. Our poor, ignorant, indifferent young people. Our children. Our future. The Post says here, first grade might seem young, but it's my daughter's third year in the New York City public school system after pre-K and kindergarten. She goes to one of the finest public schools in the city, yet knows about George Washington exclusively from the soundtrack of the Broadway show Hamilton. She wouldn't be able to tell you who discovered America. All that she knows about the early history of the United States comes from a Broadway show. I saw a clip the other day, by the way, from Neil Ferguson, a great historian. I mean, he seems like he writes one history book after another, one every year almost. And he's receiving this award for something that he's written, and he gets up and he says, you know, thank you for this notoriety. Thank you for this praise. But you should be praising so-and-so, whoever the guy is that created Hamilton, and put this history together, I think, with hip-hop music, I believe. I don't know much about Hamilton, but and maybe there's some truth to the storyline. In any event, here's one of the best historians of our day praising Hamilton because, as he knows, Neil Ferguson, he knows that that's really the only way the message gets out to a large audience. You could be the best historian in the world. But still, how many among the younger generation are going to really, really take an interest in it? The teachers don't take an interest in it. We were talking in another meeting just the other day, and of course this goes back a couple decades in my case. Not quite that long for Sam and some of the others, but just how in our high school experience, again, there wasn't much of an interest in teaching history. A lot of the teachers that were assigned to history classes, I can remember this well, they were brought to the high school mainly for coaching sports. And so they've got to do something during the day since they coach or manage the team late in the afternoon. So what do they do during the day? Well, they can't teach physics, I guess, or they can't teach algebra too. So what should we put them in? Oh, how about history? I mean, it's low on the priority list. Let's put them in history. They don't know Spanish. I mean, they can't be the Spanish teacher. That's the world of today. I mean, I can vouch for what's brought out in that 1985 article. That's when I was in high school. But you think about the high schoolers of today. Is history important? How high of a priority is it in your life? It says the Brooklyn teacher I spoke with says instructors balk when it comes to history. They don't want to offend anyone. Instead of addressing sticky subjects, we skip them altogether. Well, we could go through some history that might offend somebody. As colleges around the country see protests to remove Thomas Jefferson's statues from their campuses, it's becoming the norm to erase the parts of history that we find uncomfortable. It's not difficult to teach children that the Pilgrims or Thomas Jefferson were imperfect, yet still responsible for so much that is good in America. So here's someone that's saying, look, okay, Okay, so you have to tell them about all the bad things Thomas Jefferson did. Well, at least tell them about the good things, too. Don't just erase it. But even, I mean, you could take that to another level when you look at it from God's perspective, as I'll cover in the final segment, particularly with respect to King David and the throne of David. It's not that David's sins are whitewashed away. I mean, that's covered in the books of Samuel and Kings. But as my father has brought out, I mean, you look into the Chronicles and you have such a positive view of that history. I mean, God really does draw attention. 1 Corinthians 10 points out that he draws attention to the mistakes as well. He wants us to learn from them. But he certainly does spotlight the positive as well. Because God is creating a royal family. He's a family man. We were born to be born into that family. As I covered in class this morning, what does God think about history, whether it's our own national history or the history in the Bible? You need it, as I played for you yesterday from Mr. Armstrong. You need the background. You need to know what happened before if you're going to be able to understand the present. I mean, without proper context, how could we ever truly come to understand the significance of the events going on around us? You know the saying, those who don't learn from history, they're doomed to repeat it. And we are repeating it. We're repeating our own history. We have to study it. There's a law of history, as my father has said so many times. It's the only way to prevent mistakes, tragedies from happening. Learning from those lessons of history. Here again, that Post article brings out the campaign to tear down monuments of famous Americans. People just want to erase it. Oh, he was a racist. He was a sexist. And so we've got to just blot it out. We've got to remove it from the center of town. We've got to take it out of our park and just not even be reminded of any of our history. If we don't like it or if it makes us uncomfortable, then just erase it. I read yesterday from that former prophet section where my father says that many authorities call history our most effective teacher. Well, you wonder how many, even today. There's a few. As I said, Neil Ferguson's, he's pretty sharp. He's written about a lot. He has a great book about the British Empire. But as he even acknowledges, you know, if kids are going to pick up anything of value in history, it's probably going to come through some kind of form of entertainment. A movie or a Broadway show. And then, of course, you have to put up with all of the historical revisionism, the inaccuracies, the, you know, fake but accurate mentality. History, true history, is one of our best teachers. It's not something that can be skipped over or ignored. It's not something that should be viewed negatively. Continuing on in this former prophet section, my father says here, these books, he's talking about the former prophets, they show that if we live the same lifestyles our forefathers did, we will attain virtually the same results, good or bad. History becomes prophecy. Not all prophecy is history, but a lot of history becomes prophecy. He says, history prophesies the fate of nations, whether they will thrive or collapse. This is a law of history. It's a law, you see. Yesterday, here again from that program, Learning from History, here's another one that I played for you. This is clip two.
As I've said before and quoted Mr. Churchill, he said, the farther back you look, the farther into the future you can see. You better learn from history or you're not going to have vision. And that's how he got all that vision he had. And everybody said he was like a prophet. Where did he get that vision? From his understanding of history. You need vision in your family. I need vision. We all need vision, or we're not going to succeed in life. We're going to be brought to desolation, to ruin. We can't stand. That's just an absolute law of history.
That's an absolute law. You have to look back in order to see what's ahead. Otherwise, without vision, as the proverb says, we're going to perish. Without vision, the people perish. That's from the Holy Bible. That's from Proverbs. So we have to look back in order to look ahead. When we come back, we'll just go through a few of those verses. I kind of paraphrased a couple on yesterday's program, but we'll break it down a little bit further there at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments. You can tell us about some important history. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
In 1 Corinthians 10, let's suppose you don't have the time to read through as much of the Old Testament as you would like. Well, in this chapter, chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul gives us a very brief synopsis of ancient Israel's history. And he says, this is something that you should learn from. And by the way, in reading through this summary, you can see how that the Old Testament and the New, they perfectly complement one another. And as Paul brings out here, you need to go back to the Old Testament and study the history and study the teaching and study the prophecy even. But so much of that history is prophecy. It's just like my father said, there's a law of history, and if we don't learn the lessons from it, it's going to break us. We break the law breaks us. Now, ancient Israel did a lot of bad things. And as I said in the first segment, God wants us to learn from those mistakes, but to then carry on and emphasize the good, the positive view. Learn from these bad examples and set the right example. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, it says, "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant." And then what does he say? How that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. All of them followed that pillar cloud. And all of them went through the Red Sea. He's talking about the Israelites coming out of Egypt. And Paul says here, I would not that you should be ignorant. I don't want you to be ignorant of your own history. I don't want you to forget what God means for us to remember. I don't want you to grow up as a generation without historical memory. That's dangerous. It's deadly dangerous. Don't be ignorant when it comes to your own history. Learn it. Verse 2 says, and we're all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. How many people even understand that Jesus Christ was the God of the Old Testament, the one who came in the flesh as Jesus Christ, that being, the Word, as he's described there in John 1? How many understand that the Word, the Logos, the spokesman, was in fact the God of the Old Testament, the one who was born as Jesus Christ? It says it right here, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 4. What a revelation. Most people in the traditional Christian world have no idea of that truth. They're totally ignorant when it comes to understanding the truth of the God of the Old Testament. Well, coming back to the Israelites themselves, it says in verse 5, but with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. And so you have all that history laid out there for us. They came out of Egypt. They went out with a high hand. They were then terrified as the Israelites, or rather the Egyptians, came after them. But then they crossed the Red Sea miraculously. It was only a few days into it, though, that they started to murmur and complain and get caught up into idolatry and all kinds of sexual sins. And that's recounted in this summary, this synopsis, verse 6. Now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. These things were our example. It's for us. Ancient Israel didn't get the point of this drama that was unfolding in their day. They didn't have God's spirit. They didn't have the heart. Moses wrote about that in Deuteronomy. They just don't have the heart to obey with joy. That's an example for us. And so we study the example of Israel coming out of Egyptian slavery. God preserved these Old Testament verses for our benefit, for our learning. Like I say, you see a perfect complementary match between these two testaments. It's like two sides of the same coin. Don't lust after things the way that they did. Don't make the same mistakes that they did. Come out of sin and keep going forward. Follow Christ. Verse 11, again it says, now all these things happened unto them for examples, and they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Listen to what my father said. This is from another Key of David program. This is a 2008 clip 3.
It's written for our admonition in this end time, mostly, primarily. It's for you. It's for me. It's for the time in which we live today. That's the time that he's talking about. Now, this gives you a good idea of what God thinks about history. This is a biblical history, but secular history is very important too, if it's in sync with the Bible. But did you know that most colleges today teach very little history, and yet God says history is absolutely critical for our well-being? Even secular history is critical that we learn. It's critical that we learn lessons about our history. And oh, how that's going to eliminate so much suffering, and that's, of course, the purpose of it.
How important is it? I mean, how should this be the lowest priority for teachers in elementary schools and secondary schools and high schools, colleges, universities. How could this subject be of least importance? It's so crucial to learn the lessons of history. Think about how much suffering it would eliminate. Think about how much we can learn from the unfolding events of today if we just had a better grasp of history. It's all written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come, the ends of this world, that it has come upon us. So this is obviously for us. And the next verse, verse 12, says, "Wherefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." It's interesting, isn't it, when you examine the context here. I mean, you could just read right through chapter 10 and think, oh, well, there's a new subject here in verse 12. But Paul is saying, look, there's this history. There's all these examples. You've got to learn from it. You better make sure you learn from the law of history. And then he says in verse 12, now you better be warned. If you think you can stand on your own without these lessons sinking in deep, without knowing your own history, if you think you can stand on that, if you think you can stand without historical memory, you better take heed, because you are about to fall. When we come back, we'll conclude with the point from my father's booklet in The Form of Prophets about God's positive view of history. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
To understand that, we have to go back to the very beginning, and I want to go through it and skip through it real rapidly. We need to have a background. You need to get the whole picture. We can get little details. You can get lost in the detail if you don't know what goes around and what's on the other side. I remember the old saying, the bear went over the mountain. He went over the mountain to see what he could see. And the other side of the mountain was all that he could see when he went over. Well, most people don't know anything except what they see immediately around them. We need to go back in time. We need to go out in space. We need to get the whole picture.
That's from Herbert Armstrong in 1985. I played that for you yesterday. And as you work your way through to the end of that message that he gave, he talks about the imminency of Christ's return. He talks about these past 6,000 years of mankind's history leading up to this great event, the greatest event in the history of the universe. And if we have that perspective about history, if we see the picture, the whole picture, it truly is the most positive subject you could ever study. The most important subject you could ever study. I mean, in the very near future, Jesus Christ's return is going to be history. It will have happened. And we'll be in the wonderful world of tomorrow in the near future, beyond the coming storm, beyond the nuclear fire, beyond the widespread captivity and disease and suffering, beyond the gloomy present, there is a beautiful future. And so Ezra, when writing the history of Chronicles, he really put the focus on Jerusalem. He put the focus on King David. He put the focus on David's throne, the land of Judah. And that's where God wants our focus. Because, as it says in Luke 1, Jesus is coming back to this earth to rule from the throne of David. In the Chronicles booklet, my father says, we need to know about the problems and the difficulties, but we need our emphasis on the positive. We need our emphasis on the positive. And God conveys such a positive view of David, even this man that made many, many mistakes. But in 1 Chronicles, there's such a positive view. Because David, even though he made those mistakes, he really did master repentance. He developed a heart like God's. That's in Acts 13. There's a positive view that we can take even with respect to correction coming from God. David received a lot of it. David really suffered through a lot of difficult times. He was corrected strongly. But look at 1 Chronicles. You can start with the former prophet's booklet. It's a wonderful place to begin your study. But you could look just right through the book itself and see this young king. Well, it spans the entire life. But early on, and this is coming out of a really depressing time, early when Goliath and the Philistines were just ramrodding their way through the region, intimidating Israel. And all these Israelites were just terrified. You know the story, of course, from 1 Samuel when David confronted Goliath. And then his anointing and then being on the run from Saul for some 17 years. And then finally he's made king, and you see in David's men a totally different spirit, courageous, bold, willing to fight for God, not afraid of giants even. It talks about how much the men of David were willing to sacrifice for David, even to give him a drink of water, risking their lives. It's pretty amazing if you look at the story in 1 Chronicles. Here were David's men slaying giants. You think of a giant slayer in the Bible, you immediately think of King David. A lot of people probably think he's the only one mentioned in the Bible. Well, there were a lot of them. A lot of giant slayers. In the middle of 1 Chronicles, you read about the Ark of the Covenant. You read about the tragedy with Uzzah, and David struggled with that, why Uzzah had to die, why God had to put him to death, and yet you see the fruit that came out from that, and David and the priesthood, all of the Israelites became so very careful about all of the, even the tiniest of instructions that God gave regarding the ark. I mean, David followed it to a T. It's a positive outcome, a positive lesson. A lesson learned. That was David learning from history. Okay, if this happens with Uzzah, then how are we going to transport this ark in the future? Then you have those beautiful chapters later on in 1 Chronicles about the plans and the preparations for the construction of God's house. David purchasing that plot of land from Ornan. And looking at that plot and saying, this is the house of God. This is God's house. He was prevented from actually building the house because of his sins. And yet you see so much positive activity. The plans, the preparations. David did it all. David gathered the wealth. David drew up the plans. David put together the priestly courts. David handed over this perfect, perfect plan to his son Solomon. And David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender, and the house that is to be builded for the eternal must be exceeding magnifical, of fame and of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. That's the positive view. Those are just a few examples of this positive view of that history. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure that you pull the former prophets off the shelf and review that if you have some time in the days ahead. And then email me about your study. You can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.